Chapter 6, The Division of Labor. The jibes usually come in the course of normal conversation. It's a very tricky experiment, and I don't think the preliminary result will hold up for long. But hey, I'm sure that by the time it's retracted, you theorists will have already explained why it just has to be right. The rivalry between experimental and theoretical physicists is often carried on with humor. But the underlying issue of occupational respect is a serious one, and every remark is noted. Anyone who works around physicists quickly realizes that theorists, the people who work with symbols, are more respected within the profession than experimenters, the people who work with things. All theorists, not just an elite group of Einsteins, receive special respect within the field. And so there is a hierarchy of status between the thousands of rank-and-file theorists and the thousands of rank-and-file experimenters who are employed in universities, government laboratories, and industry. As a student, teacher, and observer of physics for the past 25 years, I've often wondered about the source of this disparity in status. Yet I have never been able to find anything within the practice of physics that accounts for it. It's worth noting that many other fields are stratified in the same way. Within economics, linguistics, sociology, and so on, theorists are looked up to more than individuals who collect and analyze data. Similarly, within the humanities, philosophy is more prestigious than other fields. The hierarchy has parallels far back in history. In the Dark Ages, the social status of priests was higher than that of craftsmen. The justifying mythology was that the priests were closer to God. But of course, the widespread belief in this mythology had a material basis, the power of the church. This example suggested what I consider to be the most incisive question that one can ask about the hierarchy of status within physics. What is the material basis for its persistence? Physicists working in the United States number anywhere from 50,000 to 100,000, depending on your definition. Experimenters outnumber theorists 2 to 1. But this ratio is not high enough to make theorists seem at all uncommon within the field or scarce within the job market. Employers put both theorists and experimenters on the same salary scale, and it is often the experimenters who control the biggest research budgets. So money, while definitely a source of status among physicists, does not account for the unequal distribution of respect between theorists and experimenters. What about intellectual freedom? Within any field, the highest status usually goes to those whose work is most independent of views set down by others. Among these individuals are those who help formulate the models that guide the work of others in the field. In physics, these are the researchers who challenge the field's paradigms or who develop new paradigms, that is, new ideologies or ways of viewing the world. These physicists, who are mostly theorists, do indeed enjoy high status within the field. However, only a handful of theorists exercise this kind of intellectual freedom in their work. Most theorists, like most experimenters, merely use the established paradigms. While intellectual freedom distinguishes an elite group of theorists, it does not explain the hierarchy that divides the rank-and-file theorists, who use the paradigms to do their calculations, from the rank-and-file experimenters, who use the paradigms to make their measurements and construct their devices. The work of these theorists and experimenters adheres with great discipline to the accepted views in their field, the paradigms. Rank-and-file scientists are ideological in their work, then, not because they produce ideology like the elite, but because they confine themselves to the given ideology without deviation. This ideological discipline is characteristic of all rank-and-file professionals who, unlike the non-professionals below them in status, are trusted to understand and use the ideology, but who, unlike the elite above them, are not employed to formulate or question the ideology. If this relationship between professionals and the ideology of their fields seems familiar, that is probably because it is the same as the relationships between professionals and the outlook of their employers, discussed at the end of the previous chapter. A relatively small number of physicists go beyond merely using the paradigms and instead work to fine-tune them. Much of today's particle physics research, both theory and experiment, is such middle-range work. This work aims to refine what is known to be the standard model, which is the prevailing theory of the properties and interactions of quarks, electrons, and other elementary particles. Many particle theorists work to extend the standard model to more phenomena, make predictions that test various parts of the theory, and reconcile the theory with experimental findings. At the same time, many particle experimenters search for new phenomena in specific areas where the theory might be extended, work to confirm or contradict parts of the theory, and measure parameters that are needed to do calculations based on the theory. This sort of middle-range work is directed by the paradigm it serves to refine, making it almost as intellectually circumscribed as the work done by the majority of physicists, which merely uses the paradigm. In any case, fine-tuning of paradigms is as likely to be done by experimenters as by theorists, and therefore cannot contribute to the difference in status between the two groups. If neither financial nor intellectual freedom is the material basis for the hierarchy that divides rank-and-file theorists and experimenters, then what is? What about the importance of the work? A conductor on a train objecting to the engineer's greater prestige and salary once asked me rhetorically, "Who is more important in an orchestra, the conductor or someone who plays an instrument?" Many workers, like this train conductor, feel they don't get the respect they deserve. They find that no matter how hard they work, their status in society stays about the same, for it is tied more to the type of work they do than to how well they do it. Hence, from conductors and teachers to nurses and secretaries, workers wanting greater respect or salaries tend to center their arguments on the unrecognized importance of their work. Within physics, however, everyone seems to agree that the field cannot advance without both theoretical and experimental work, and the notion that the work of rank-and-file theorists is more important than that of their colleagues in the lab is only infrequently put forward. Finally, consider intellectual difficulty. Of course, the intellectual difficulty of any job is largely a matter of opinion. Nevertheless, a job's reputed intellectual difficulty is an important source of social status. In a research laboratory, a physicist or even a graduate student has higher social status than a machinist, glassblower, or electronics technician, even though the skilled worker may have a higher salary because of greater seniority. The physicist is simply thought to do the more intellectually difficult work, and by design, the physicist generally does. However, the opposite is frequently true on important components of a project, because it is often intellectually easier to figure out what needs to be done than to actually do it. It may not tax the physicist's mind to say, "An ultra-sensitive picosecond pulse counter would certainly do the job here," or, "Make a large circular flange and find its center to within a half a thousandth of an inch." But designing the needed components, building them, and making them work, which may be the technician's assignment, can involve much more difficult problem-solving. If physicists have higher status than technicians because in most cases their work is genuinely more intellectually difficult, then is there also a genuine imbalance of intellectual difficulty between theory and experiment that accounts for the hierarchy among the physicists themselves? Indeed, the work of the rank-and-file theorist is generally thought to be more intellectually difficult than that of the rank-and-file experimenter. But experimental work, like theoretical work, is mainly intellectual labor, and coming up with a strategy to attack a theoretical problem is not necessarily more intellectually difficult than coming up with a strategy to attack an experimental one. Actually, carrying out the experimental approach involves both intellectual and manual work, just as carrying out the theoretical approach involves both intellectual and clerical work. The clerical work, tedious algebraic manipulations, computer programming and debugging, looking up mathematical relations, and so on, severely limits the pace of the research, and theorists cannot claim to spend a larger fraction of their time on creative work than do experimenters. An advertisement in physics today for computer software that does algebra and other symbolic manipulation invites frustrated theorists to, quote, imagine having more time to ponder the abstract rather than having to derive the solution. In any case, and this is the problem, the reality doesn't seem to matter much. Even though making nature behave in the laboratory is clearly as intellectually difficult as making models of nature behave on paper, people simply do not associate the former with intelligence to the same extent. Good measurements require as much cleverness as good calculations, but there is a tendency to see them as requiring less. Feeling at home in the physical world, the world of apparatus, is just as much an intellectual achievement as feeling at home in the symbolic world, the world of equations, but people generally consider it a lesser accomplishment. Theorists have higher social status, but not because their work is any more intellectually difficult, but because people perceive it to be. What accounts for this false perception? To most people, theory's greater intellectual difficulty is simply a matter of common sense. What then is the source of this mistaken common sense about work in science? The answer can be found in the structure of work in the larger society, beginning with the separation of mental and manual work, of conception and execution. The division of labor is inherently hierarchical and makes possible a hierarchical system of production in which non-laborers control the products of the work of laborers. I use the term non-laborers here in a very narrow sense to refer specifically to those at the top of hierarchy of production in any of the world's hierarchical economic systems. Non-laborers are those who control the employing institutions, whether through the party, as in communist countries, or through the government, as in socialist countries, or through ownership, as in capitalist countries. The hierarchical system of production looms large in the lives of people throughout society, and every individual is keenly aware of where he or she stands in it. Those who control the employing institutions and who enjoy the right to treat the products of labor as their own have great power both in the workplace and in the larger society, and have higher social status than the laborers. This basic arrangement sets the tone for the culture, which mediates the assignment of status to people throughout the society. In the culture, work gains social status if it resembles in form the activity of those at the top, and loses status if it resembles the work of laborers. Thus, the manipulation of symbols has a higher social status than the manipulation of things. The culture makes a fetish of this hierarchy of mental over manual work, carrying it beyond the immediate needs of the system of production. So if your job requires getting your hands dirty, you automatically have one strike against you as far as social status goes. Whereas, if your job is extremely intellectual, your work is seen as semi-divine, glowing with the radiance of disembodied thought. This explains, finally, the higher social status of rank-and-file theorists over rank-and-file experimenters. These scientists have equal financial and intellectual freedom and do work of equal importance and intellectual difficulty, making them technically equal performers within the hierarchical system of production itself. However, in the fetishizing culture associated with that system of production, the work of the experimenter is tainted by its manual component. As such, it is seen as less intellectually difficult and less deserving of status. Hence, while the dominance of non-laborers over laborers in the larger society is the material basis for the higher social status of rank-and-file theorists over rank-and-file experimenters, it is the companion culture that actually hands the theorists their higher status. This culture is the source of the common sense that the work of theorists is more intellectually difficult than that of experimenters. The ranking of respect within physics comes from outside of physics. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt. Continuing with the final subsection of Chapter 6, Weakening the Individual. The culprit, the hierarchical division of labor, has another dimension relevant to physics. It leads to extreme specialization. In particle physics, for example, it is not unusual now for several hundred physicists from several dozen institutions to collaborate on a single experiment at an accelerator laboratory. Thus, one routine paper in physics letters reporting results from a standard model experiment at the European Particle Accelerator Laboratory, CERN, has 562 authors from 39 universities and government laboratories. Each institutional group of physicists contributes a component of the experiment, and individual physicists within each group specialize even further. In any case, the typical physicist in the collaboration does work in which no amount of creativity could significantly influence the overall course of the experiment. And with narrow work assignments, individual initiative is more likely to cross boundaries and to be seen as intrusive, even if it makes sense scientifically. The division of labor within research projects is often so hierarchical that the distribution of authority is more like that of the military than that of a democracy. Professors are at the top and are themselves organized in a strict hierarchy. You can usually tell who's at the apex by looking at who is getting publicity, because the professors who have the most power within a physics project usually designate themselves as spokesmen and forbid other professors to speak to the press. Next in line are the research physicists, who are the PhDs whom the professors hire with their federal contract or grant money. Research physicists get professorial wages but do not get tenure or a vote at meetings of their university physics department. Postdocs follow, and graduate students are at the bottom. There is not even a pretense of democracy among these scientists. The professors at the top of the hierarchy have total creative control over the experiment. If a physicist below the top has a real say in what is done, that is not because a democratic structure ensures it, but because an individual at the top happens to be a good boss and allows it. Those who are troubled by such practices within any field should examine the larger society within which the field operates. A critical and somewhat detailed examination of the division of labor outside of physics, for example, is necessary for anyone concerned about the practice of physics. First, this type of examination provides a deeper understanding of the external sources of the hierarchy within physics, and thereby allows one to judge for oneself how amenable to change that source might be. Second, it alerts us to practices to watch out for in physics, for no field is immune to the increasing division of labor and the problems that come with it. While these problems may be most noticeable in large physics projects, they are certainly not confined to big physics. So having traced the higher status of theorists to the hierarchical division of labor outside of physics, let us take a closer look at the role the division of labor plays in work as it is usually organized in the larger society. No matter what the product is, employers divide the work into many parts and assign each employee one type of activity. Narrowly focused individuals can work in a more machine-like way and get more work done per hour. Moreover, people who exercise fewer skills or simpler skills can be paid less. Hence, employers label the division of labor efficient. But it is efficient only if one ignores the social cost of organizing production in a way in which jobs tend to be monotonous and unsatisfying. Such jobs, instead of allowing individuals to develop their mental and physical abilities by exercising them freely and fully, that is, instead of being fun, numb the mind and the body, and retard the personal development of those employed to do them. A system of production that works efficiently toward the goals of employers does not necessarily work efficiently toward the goals of employees or toward the goals of society in general. More important to employers than the economic benefits, however, are the political benefits of the division of labor. Benefits that help management maintain its authority in the workplace, confined to a range of activity that is limited both horizontally and vertically, employees do not gain first-hand knowledge of the overall organization, strategy, or goals of the institution that employs them. Those who work within this division of labor see the consequent ignorance in themselves and in their co-workers and feel a need to be directed by people who comprehend the whole operation. Management has the broadest view of what is going on, and this helps make its supreme authority in the workplace seem natural and justified. We should note, however, that even as employees feel the need for managers, they don't actually like being managed. Least accepting of management's authority are those who imagine greater self-management, at least for themselves. When employee resentment of managerial authority becomes sufficiently deep and widespread, the efficient system of production becomes inefficient even from management's selfish point of view, because disaffected employees engage in what amounts to silent personal strikes. Thus, employee absenteeism, sloppy work, hostile attitudes, and so on have forced some companies to ease up on the strict know-your-place division of labor and try systems of production that are more personally empowering and engaging. These systems of greater self-management do require a less rigid division of labor so that employees can gain a broad understanding of the organization they are part of, not through rumors and company newsletters, but through real participation in a wide range of activity at all levels. Discouraging employees from thinking about self-management is not the only political function of the division of labor. By making employees easier to replace and by deflating their feeling of accomplishment in their work, the division of labor strips workers of their sense of power in the workplace, discouraging them from challenging management on the way the work is organized. And the division of work into narrow tasks, most of which are the same even when the product is different, denies workers a feeling for what they are producing, thereby discouraging them from challenging management on the nature or design of the product or service. Hence, the division of labor, by making self-management seem impossible, and by strengthening management's control over the workforce and over the content of the work, helps make the hierarchical system of production more secure. The historical trend is toward an increasingly fine division of labor and an increasingly strict confinement of individual employees to their assigned areas of work. This trend affects professionals and non-professionals alike, distancing all employees from decision-making on the overarching moral and political issues. Professionals are forced into increasingly narrow specializations during training, and more than ever must specialize even further once on the job, especially when they are employed in large organizations, as is increasingly the case. So even the employees whom management trusts politically to use relatively broad technical and organizational knowledge of the production process find management confining them to work on smaller and smaller pieces of the big picture. No professionals are immune. Even philosophers, who at one time struggled to develop thought that encompassed all of human endeavors, are now hired on the basis of their willingness and ability to carry out the minutely specialized work of analytical philosophy. Consequently, they increasingly identify themselves as masters of the associated specialized tools and methods, rather than as independent moral and political thinkers. Scientists, who are this chapter's main example, and whose specialization is typical of salaried professionals in all fields, should look critically at this division of labor and the problems that come with it. Social hierarchies are sources of social friction, and those in science are no exception. Reducing the division of labor within science, and doing what we can to chip away at the external ones, will help break down social hierarchies in science, and can only help make scientific work more fruitful, more socially beneficial, and more fun.